Ed disliked the rain, Sabriel thought inconsequentially, as she considered this question. Rain didn't destroy, but it hurt and irritated the dead. Wherever the dead thing was on the island, it would be out of the rain. She stood up with that thought. 31 pairs of eyes watched her, hardly blinking, despite the cloying smoke from too many lanterns, candles, and tapers. Touchdown watched the villagers. Mogget watched a piece of fish. Sabriel closed her eyes, questing outward with other senses, trying to feel the presence of the dead. It was there, a faint, concealed emanation, like an untraceable whiff of something rotten. Sabriel concentrated on it, followed it, and found it, right there in the shed. The dead was somehow hiding among the villagers. She opened her eyes slowly, looking straight at the point where her senses told her the dead creature lurked. She saw a fisherman, middle-aged, his salt-etched face red under sun-bleached hair. He seemed no different than the others around him, listening intently for her reply, but there was definitely something dead in him, or very close by. He was wearing a boat cloak, which seemed odd, since the smoking shed was hot from massed humanity and the many lights. "Tell me," Sabriel said, "did anyone bring a large box with them out to the island? Something, say, an arm span square aside, or larger? It would be heavy, with grave dirt." Murmurs and inquiries met this question, neighbours turning to each other, with little flowerings of fear and suspicion. As they talked, Sabriel walked out through them, surreptitiously loosening her sword, signalling Touchstone to stay close by her. He followed her, eyes flickering across the little groups of villagers. Mogget, glancing up from his fish, stretched and lazily stalked behind Touchstone's heels, after a warning glare at the two cats who were eyeing the half-consumed head and tail of his fishy repast. Careful not to alarm her quarry, Sabriel took a zigzag path through the shed, listening to the villagers with studied attention, though the blonde fisherman never left the corner of her eye. He was deep in discussion with another man, who seemed to be growing more suspicious by the second. Closer now, Sabriel was sure that the fisherman was a vassal of the dead. Technically, he was still alive, but a dead spirit had suppressed his will, riding on his flesh like some shadowy string-puller, using his body as a puppet. Something highly unpleasant would be half-submerged in his back, under the boat cloak. Mordout, they were called, Sabriel remembered. A whole page was devoted to these parasitical spirits in the Book of the Dead. They liked to keep a primary host alive, slipping off at night to sate their hunger from other living prey, like children.
"I'm sure I saw you with a box like that, Pata,"
the suspicious fisherman was saying.
"Jal Stewart helped you get it ashore. Hey, Jal!"
He shouted that last, turning to look at someone else across the room. In that instant, the dead-ridden Pata exploded into action, clubbing his questioner with both forearms, knocking him aside, running to the door with the silent ferocity of a battering-ram. But Sabriel had expected that. She stood before him, sword at the ready, her left hand drawing Runner, the sweet sleeper, from the bandolier. She still hoped to save the man by quelling the Mordaunt. Pata slid to a halt and half-turned, but Touchstone was there behind him, twin swords glowing eerily, with shifting charter marks and silver flames. Sabriel eyed the blades in surprise. She hadn't known they were spelled. Past time she asked, she realized. Then Runner was free in her hand, but the Mordaunt didn't wait for the unavoidable lullaby. Pata suddenly screamed and stood rigid, the redness draining from his face, to be replaced by grey. Then his flesh crumpled and fell apart, even his bones flaking away to soggy ash, as the Mordaunt sucked all the life out of him in one voracious instant. Newly fed and strengthened, the dead slid out from the falling cloak, a pool of squelching darkness. It took shape as it moved, becoming a large, disgustingly elongated sort of rat. Quicker than any natural rat, it scuttled towards a hole in the wall and escape. Sabriel lunged, her blade striking chips from the floor planks, missing the shadowy form by a scant instant. Touchstone didn't miss. His right-hand sword sheared through the creature just behind the head, the left-wielded blade impaling its sinuous midsection. Pinned to the floor, the creature writhed and arched, its shadow stuff working away from the blades. It was remaking its body, escaping the trap. Quickly, Sabriel stood over it, runner sounding in her hand, sweet, lazy tone echoing out into the shed. Before the echoes died, the Mordaunt ceased to writhe. Form half lost by its shifting from the swords, it lay like a lump of charred liver, quivering on the floor, still impaled. Sabriel replaced Runner, and drew the eager Saraneth. Its forceful voice snapped out, sound weaving a net of domination over the foul creature. The Mordaunt made no effort to resist, even to make a mouth to whine its cause. Sabriel felt it succumb to her will via the medium of Saraneth. She put the bell back, but hesitated as her hand fell on Kibeth. Sleeper and master had spoken well, but Walker sometimes had its own ideas, and it was stirring suspiciously under her hand. Best to wait a moment to calm herself, Sabriel thought, taking her hand away from the bandolier. She sheathed her sword and looked around the shed. To her surprise, everyone except Touchstone and Mogget was asleep. They had only caught the echoes of Runner, which shouldn't have been enough. Of course, Runner could be tricksome too, but its trickery was far less troublesome. "This is a Mordaunt," she said to Touchstone, who was stifling a half-born yawn. "A weak spirit, catalogued as one of the lesser dead. They like to ride with the living, cohabiting the body to some extent, directing it, and slowly seeing the spirit away. It makes them hard to find." "What do we do with it now?" asked Touchstone, eyeing the quivering lump of shadow with distaste. It clearly couldn't be cut up, consumed by fire, or anything else he could think of. "I will banish it, send it back to die a true death," replied Sabriel. Slowly, she drew Kibeth, using both hands. She still felt uneasy, for the bell was twisting in her grasp, trying to sound of its own accord, a sound that would make her walk in death. She gripped it harder, and rang the orthodox backwards, forwards, and figure eight her father had taught her. Kibeth's voice rang out, singing a merry tune, a capering jig that almost had Sabriel's feet jumping too, till she forced herself to be absolutely still. The Mordaunt had no such free will. For a moment, Touchstone thought it was getting away, the shadow form suddenly leaping upwards, unreal flesh slipping up his blades almost to the cross-hilts. Then it slid back down again and vanished, back into death, to bob and spin in the current, howling and screaming with whatever voice it had there, all the way through to the final gate. "Thanks," Sabriel said to Touchstone. She looked down at his two swords, still deeply embedded in the wooden floor. They were no longer burning with silver flames, but she could see the charter marks moving on the blades. "I didn't realize your swords were ensorcelled," she continued, "though I'm glad they are." Surprise crossed Touchstone's face, and confusion. "I thought you knew," he said. "I took them from the Queen's ship. They were a royal champion's swords. I didn't want to take them, but Mogget said you—" He stopped in mid-sentence as Sabriel let out a heartfelt sigh. "Well, anyway," he continued, "legend has it that the Wallmaker made them at the same time he, or she, I suppose, made your sword." "Mine?" asked Sabriel, her hand lightly touching the worn bronze of the guard. She'd never thought about who'd made the sword. It just was. "I was made for Abhorsen, to slay those already dead," the inscription said, when it said anything lucid at all. So it probably was forged long ago, back in the distant past, when the wall was made. Mogget would know, she thought. Mogget probably wouldn't, or couldn't, tell her, but he would know. I suppose we'd better wake everybody up, she said, dismissing speculation about swords for the immediate present. Are there more dead? Asked Touchstone, grunting, as he pulled his swords free of the floor. I don't think so, replied Sabriel. That Mordaunt was very clever, for it had hardly sapped the spirit of poor Patar, so its presence was masked by his life. He would have come to the island in that box of grave dirt, having impressed the poor man with instructions before they left the mainland. I doubt whether any others would have done the same. I can't sense any here, at least. I guess I should check the other buildings and walk around the island just to be sure. Now? Asked Touchstone. Now, confirmed Sabriel. But let's wake everyone up first, and organize some people to carry lights for us. We'd also better talk to the Elder about a boat for the morning.
And a good supply of fish,
added Mogget, who'd slunk back to the half-eaten whiting, his voice sharp above the heavy drone of snoring fisherfolk. There were no dead on the island, though the archers reported seeing strange lights moving in the village during brief lulls in the rain. They'd heard movement on the breakwater, too, and shot fire arrows onto the stones, but saw nothing before the crude, oily rag-wrap shafts guttered out. Sabriel advanced out on the breakwater and stood near the sea gap, her oilskin coat loosely draped over her shoulders, shedding rain to the ground and down her neck. She couldn't see anything through the rain and dark, but she could feel the dead. There were more than she had sensed earlier, or they had grown much stronger. Then, with a sickening feeling, she realized that this strength belonged to a single creature, only now emerging from death, using the broken stone as a portal. An instant later, she recognized its particular presence. The Mordicant had found her. Touchstone, she asked, fighting to keep the shivers from her voice, can you sail a boat by night? Yes, replied Touchstone, his voice impersonal again, face dark in the rainy night, the lantern light from the villagers behind him lighting only his back and feet. He hesitated, as if he shouldn't be offering an opinion, then added, but it would be much more dangerous. I don't know this coast, and the night is very dark. Mogget can see in the dark, Sabriel said quietly, moving closer to Touchstone, so the villagers couldn't hear her. We have to leave immediately, she whispered, while pretending to adjust her oilskin. A Mordicant has come, the same one that pursued me before. What about the people here? Asked Touchstone, so softly the sound of the rain almost washed his words away, but there was the faint sound of reproof under his businesslike tone. The Mordicant is after me, muttered Sabriel. She could sense it moving away from the stone, questing about, using its otherworldly senses to find her. It can feel my presence as I feel it. When I go, it will follow. If we stay till morning, Touchstone whispered back, won't we be safe? You said even a Mordicant couldn't cross this gap. I said, I think, faltered Sabriel. It has grown stronger. I can't be sure. That thing back in the shed, the Mordaunt, it wasn't very difficult to destroy, Touchstone whispered, the confidence of ignorance in his voice. Is this Mordicant much worse?
Much, replied Sabriel shortly.
The Mordicant had stopped moving. The rain seemed to be dampening both its senses and its desire to find her and slay. Sabriel stared vainly out into the darkness, trying to peer past the sheets of rain, to gain the evidence provided by sight, as well as her necromantic senses.
Rima,
she said, loudly now, calling to the villager who was in charge of their lantern holders. He came forward quickly, gingery hair plastered flat on his rounded head, rainwater dripping down from a high forehead to catapult itself off the end of his pudgy nose.
Rima, have the archers keep very careful watch.
Tell them to shoot anything that comes onto the breakwater. There is nothing living out there now, only the dead. We need to go back and talk to your elder. They walked back in silence, save for the sloshing of boots in puddles and the steady finger applause of the rain. At least half of Sabriel's attention stayed with the mordicant, a malign, stomachache-inducing presence across the dark water. She wondered why it was waiting, waiting for the rain to stop, or perhaps for the now banished Mordaunt to attack from within. Whatever its reasons, it gave them a little time to get to a boat and lead it away. And perhaps there was always the chance that it couldn't cross the breakwater gap. "What time is low tide?" she asked Rima, as a new thought struck.
"Oh, just about an hour before dawn," replied the fisherman. "About 6 hours, if I'm any judge."
The elder awoke crankily from his second sleep. He was loath for them to go in the night, though Sabriel felt that at least half of his reluctance was due to their need for a boat. The villagers only had 5 left. The others had been sunk in the harbour, drowned and broken by the stones hurled down by the dead, eager to stop the escape of their living prey. "I'm sorry," Sabriel said again, "but we must have a boat, and we need it now. There is a terrible dead creature in the village. It tracks like a hunting dog, and the trail it follows is mine. If I stay, it will try and come here, and at the ebb, it may be able to cross the gap in the breakwater. If I go, it will follow."
"Very well," the elder agreed mulishly. "You have cleansed this island for us. A boat is a little thing. Rima will prepare it with food and water. Rima, the Ab Horsen will have Landolin's boat. Make sure it is stocked and seaworthy. Take sails from Jaled, if Landolin's is short or rotten."
"Thank you," said Sabriel. Tiredness weighed down on her. Tiredness and the weight of awareness. Awareness of her enemies, like a darkness always clouding the edge of her vision. "We will go now. My good wishes stay with you, and my hopes for your safety."
"May the charter preserve us all," added Touchstone, bowing to the old man.
The elder bowed back, a bent, solemn figure, so much smaller than his shadow, looming tall on the wall behind. Sabriel turned to go, but a long line of villagers was forming on the way to the door. All of them wanted to bow or curtsy before her, to mutter shy thank yous and farewells. Sabriel accepted them with embarrassment and guilt, remembering Ptah. True, she had banished the dead, but another life had been lost in the doing. Her father would not have been so clumsy. The second to last person in the line was a little girl, her black hair tied in 2 plaits, one on either side of her head. Seeing her made Sabriel remember something Touchstone had said. She stopped and took the girl's hands in her own. "What is your name, little one?" she asked, smiling. A feeling of déjà vu swept over her as the small fingers met hers. The memory of a frightened first grader, hesitantly reaching out to the older pupil who would be her guide for the first day at Wyverley College. Sabriel had experienced both sides in her time.
"Aline,"
said the girl, smiling back. Her eyes were bright and lively, too young to be dimmed by the frightened despair that clouded the adult's gaze. A good choice, Sabriel thought. "Now tell me what you have learned in your lessons about the Great Charter," Sabriel said, adopting the familiar, motherly, and generally irrelevant questioning tone of the school inspector who descended on every class in Wyverley twice a year.
"I know the rhyme," replied Aline, a little doubtfully, her small forehead crinkling. "Shall I sing it, like we do in class?"
Sabriel nodded.
"We dance around the stone, too," Aline added confidingly.
She stood up straighter, put one foot forward, and took her hands away to clasp them behind her back.
"5 great charters knit the land. together linked, hand in hand. One in the people who wear the crown, two in the folk who keep the dead down. Three in five became stone and mortar. Four sees all in frozen water.
Thank you, Aline, Sabriel said. That was very nice. She ruffled the child's hair and hastened through the final farewells, suddenly keen to get out of the smoke and the fish smell, out into the clean, rainy air where she could think.
So now you know, whispered Mogget,
jumping up into her arms to escape the puddles.
I still can't tell you, but you know one's in your blood.
Two, replied Sabriel distantly, two in the folk who keep the dead down.
So what is the... Ah, I can't talk about it either. But she thought about the question she'd like to ask, as Touchstone helped her aboard the small fishing vessel that lay just off the tiny, shell-laden beach that served the island as a harbour. One of the great charters lay in the royal blood. The second lay in Abhorsen's. What were three and five? And four that saw all in frozen water? She felt certain that many answers could be found in Belisaire. Her father could probably answer more, for many things that were bound in life were unravelled in death. And there was her mother sending, for that third and final questioning in this 7 years. Touchstone pushed off, clambered aboard, and took the oars. Mogget leapt out of Sabriel's arms and assumed a figurehead position near the prow, serving as a night-sighted lookout, while mocking Touchstone at the same time. Back on shore, the mordicant suddenly howled, a long, piercing cry that echoed far across the water, chilling hearts on both boat and island.
"Bear a bit more to starboard," said Mogget,
in the silence after the howl faded.
"We need more sea room."
Touchstone was quick to comply. Chapter 18. By the morning of the sixth day out of Nesto, Sabriel was heartily tired of nautical life. They'd sailed virtually non-stop all that time, only putting into shore at noon for fresh water, and only then when it was sunny. Nights were spent under sail, or, when exhaustion claimed Touchstone, hove to with a sea anchor, the unsleeping Mogget standing watch. Fortunately, the weather had been kind. It had been a relatively uneventful 5 days. 2 days from Nesto to Beardy Point, an unprepossessing peninsula whose only interesting features were a sandy-bottomed beach and a clear stream. Devoid of life, it was also devoid of the dead. Here, for the first time, Sabriel could no longer sense the pursuing mordicant. A good, strong southeasterly had propelled them, reaching northwards, at too fast a pace for it to follow. 3 days from Beardy Point to the island of Ilgard, its rocky cliffs climbing sheer from the sea, a grey and pockmarked tenement, home to tens of thousands of seabirds. They passed it late in the afternoon, their single sail stretched to bursting, clinker-built hull heeling well over, bow slicing up a column of spray that salted mouths, eyes, and bodies. It was half a day from Ilgard to the Belis mouth, that narrow strait that led to the Sea of Sair. But that was tricky sailing, so they spent the night hove to, just out of sight of Ilgard, to wait for the light of day. "There is a boom chain across the Belis mouth," Touchstone explained, as he raised the sail and Sabriel hauled the sea anchor in over the bow. The sun was rising behind him, but had not yet pulled itself out of the sea, so he was no more than a dim shadow in the stern. It was built to keep pirates and such like out of the Sea of Sair. You won't believe the size of it. I can't imagine how it was forged or strung across. "Will it still be there?" Sabriel asked cautiously, not wanting to prevent Touchstone's strangely talkative mood. "I'm sure of it," replied Touchstone. "We'll see the towers on the opposite shores first, Winding Post to the south, and Boom Hook to the north. Not very imaginative names, commented Sabriel, unable to help herself from interrupting. It was just such a pleasure to talk. Touchstone had lapsed back into non-communication for most of the voyage, though he did have a good excuse. Handling the fishing boat for 18 hours a day, even in good weather, didn't leave much energy for conversation. They're named after their purpose, replied Touchstone, which makes sense. Who decides whether to let vessels pass the chain? Asked Sabriel. Already she was thinking ahead, wondering about Belisaire. Could it be like Nesto, the city abandoned, riddled with the dead?
Ah, said Touchstone. I hadn't thought about that.
In my time, there was a royal boommaster, with a force of guards and a squadron of small picket ships. If, as Moggit says, the city has fallen into anarchy,
there may also be people working for or in alliance with the dead, Sabriel added thoughtfully. So, even if we cross the boom in daylight, there could be trouble. I think I'd better reverse my surcoat and hide my helmet wrapping.
What about the bells? Asked Touchstone.
He leaned past her to draw the main sheet tighter, right hand slightly nudging the tiller to take advantage of a shift in the wind.
They're fairly obvious, to say the least.
I'll just look like a necromancer, Sabriel replied. A salty, unwashed cromancer.
I don't know, said Touchstone, who couldn't see that Sabriel was joking. No necromancer would be let into the city, or would stay alive in...
In your day, interrupted Moggit from his favourite post on the bow. But this is now, and I'm sure that necromancers and worse are not uncommon sights in Belisaire.
I'll wear a cloak, Sabriel started to say.
If you say so, Touchstone said at the same time.
Clearly he didn't believe the cat. Belisaire was the royal capital, a huge city, home to at least 50,000 people. Touchstone couldn't imagine it fallen, decayed, and in the hands of the dead. Despite his own inner fears and secret knowledge, he couldn't help but be confident that the Belisaire they were sailing towards would be little different from the 200-year-old images locked in his memory. That confidence took a blow as the Belismouth towers became visible above the blue line of the horizon on opposite shores of the strait. At first, the towers were no more than dark smudges that grew taller as wind and wave carried the boat towards them. Through her telescope, Sabriel saw that they were made from a beautiful, rosy pink stone that once must have been magnificent. Now they were largely blackened by fire. Their majesty vanished. Winding Post had lost the top 3 stories, from 7. Boom Hook stood as tall as ever, but sunlight shone through gaping holes, showing the interior to be a gutted ruin. There was no sign of any garrison, toll collector, windlass mules, or anything alive. The great boom chain still stretched across the strait. Huge iron links, each as wide and long as the fishing boat, rose green and barnacle-befouled out of the water and up into each of the towers. Glimpses of it could be seen in the middle of the mouth, when the swell dipped, and a length of chain shone, slick and green in the wave trough, like some lurking monster of the deep.
We'll have to go in close to the winding post tower, unstep the mast, and row under the chain where it rises, Touchstone declared, after studying the chain for several minutes through the telescope, trying to gauge whether it had sunk enough to allow them passage. But even with their relatively shallow draft boat, it would be too risky, and they daren't wait for high tide late in the afternoon. At some time in the past, perhaps when the towers were abandoned, the chain had been winched up to its maximum tension. The engineers who'd made it would have been pleased, for there seemed to be no noticeable slippage.
Moggit, go to the bow and keep a lookout for anything in the water. Sabriel, could you please watch the shore and the tower to guard against attack?
Sabriel nodded, pleased that Touchstone's stint as captain of their small vessel had done a lot to remove the servant nonsense out of him and make him more like a normal person. Mogget, for his part, jumped up to the bow without protest, despite the spray that occasionally burst over his head as they cut diagonally across the swell towards the small triangle of opportunity between shore, sea, and chain. They came in as close as they dared before unstepping the mast. The swell had diminished, for the Belly's mouth was well sheltered by the two arms of land, but the tide had turned, and a tidal race was beginning to run from the ocean to the Sayre Sea. So, even without mast and sail, they were borne rapidly towards the chain, Touchstone rowing with all his strength just to keep steerage way. After a moment, this clearly became impossible, so Sabriel took one of the oars, and they rowed together, with Mogget yowling directions. Every few seconds, at the end of a full stroke, her back nearly level with the thwarts, Sabriel snatched a glimpse over her shoulder. They were headed for the narrow passage between the high but crumbling seawall of Winding Post and the enormous chain rising out of the swift-flowing sea in a swath of white froth. She could hear the melancholy groaning of the lynx, like a chorus of pained walruses. Even that gargantuan chain moved at the sea's whim.
"Port a little!"
yowled Mogget. Touchstone backed his oar for a moment. Then the cat jumped down, yelling,
"Ship, oars, and duck!"
The oars came rattling, splashing in, both Sabriel and Touchstone simply lying down on their backs, with Mogget somewhere between them. The boat rocked and plunged, and the groan of the chain sounded close and terrible. Sabriel, one moment looking up at the clear blue sky, in the next saw nothing but green, weed-strewn iron above her. When the swell lifted the boat up, she could have reached out and touched the great boom chain of Belly's mouth. Then they were past, and Touchstone was already pushing out his oar, Mogget moving to the bow. Sabriel wanted to lie there, just looking up at the sky, but the collapsed seawall of Winding Post was no more than an oar length away. She sat up and resumed her duty as a rower. The water changed colour in the Sea of Sayre. Sabriel trailed her hand in it, marvelling at its clear turquoise sheen. For all its colour, it was incredibly transparent. The water was very deep, but she could see down the first three or four fathoms, watching small fish dance under the bubbles of their wake. She felt relaxed, momentarily carefree, all the troubles that lay ahead and behind her temporarily lost in single-minded contemplation of the clear blue-green water. There was no dead presence here, no constant awareness of the many doors to death. Even charter magic was dissipated at sea. For a few minutes, she forgot about Touchstone and Mogget. Even her father faded from her mind. There was only the sea's colour and its coolness on her hand.
"We'll be able to see the city soon," Touchstone said, interrupting her mental holiday, "if the towers are still standing."
Sabriel nodded thoughtfully and slowly took her hand from the sea, as if she were parting from a dear friend. "It must be difficult for you," she said, almost to herself, not really expecting him to answer. 200 years gone, the kingdom slowly falling into ruin while you slept.
I didn't really believe it, till I saw Nesto, and then the Belly's Mouth Towers, replied Touchstone. Now I'm afraid, even for a great city that I never believed could really change.
No imagination, said Mogget sternly. No thinking ahead. A flaw in your character, a fatal flaw.
Mogget, Sabriel said indignantly, angry at the cat for crushing yet another possible conversation. Why are you so rude to Touchstone? Mogget hissed, and the fur bristled on his back.
I am accurate, not rude, he snapped, turning his back to them with studied scorn. And he deserves it.
I'm sick of this,
announced Sabriel. Touchstone, what does Mogget know that I don't? Touchstone was silent, knuckles white on the tiller, eyes focused on the distant horizon, as if he could already see the towers of Belisaire.
You'll have to tell me eventually, said Sabriel,
a touch of the prefect entering her voice.
It can't be that bad, surely.
Touchstone wet his lips, hesitated, then spoke.
It was stupidity on my part, not evil, m'lady. 200 years ago, when the last queen reigned, I know, that I am partly responsible for the failing of the kingdom, the end of the royal line.
What? Exclaimed Sabriel. How could you be?
I am, continued Touchstone miserably, his hand shaking so much the tiller moved, giving the boat a crazy zigzag wake. There was a... that is...
He paused, took a deep breath, sat up a little straighter, and continued, as if reporting to a senior officer.
I don't know how much I can tell you, because it involves the Great Charters. Where do I start? With the Queen, I guess. She had 4 children. Her oldest son, Roger, was a childhood playmate of mine. He was always the leader in all our games. He had the ideas, we followed them. Later, when we were growing up, his ideas became stranger, less nice. We grew apart. I went into the guard. He pursued his own interests. Now I know that those interests must have included free magic and necromancy. I never suspected it then. I should have, I know. But he was secretive and often away. Towards the end, I mean a few months before it happened, well, Roger had been away for several years. He came back just before the midwinter festival. I was glad to see him, for he seemed to be more like he was as a child. He'd lost interest in the bizarrities that had attracted him. We spent more time together again, hawking, riding, drinking, dancing. Then, late one afternoon, one cold, crisp afternoon, near sunset, I was on duty guarding the Queen and her ladies. They were playing Cranach. Roger came to her and asked her to come with him down to the place where the great stones are.
Hey, I can say it!
Yes, interrupted Mogget.
He looked tired, like an alley cat that has suffered one kick too many.
The sea washes all things clear for a time. We can speak of the Great Charters, at least for a little while. I had forgotten it was so.
Go on, said Sabriel excitedly. Let's take advantage of it while we can. The great stones would be the stones and mortar of the rhyme, the 3rd and 5th Great Charter.
Yes, replied Touchstone, remotely, as if reciting a lesson. With the wall. The people, or whatever they were, who made the Great Charters, put 3 in bloodlines, and 2 in physical constructions, the wall and the great stones. All the lesser stones draw their power from one or the other.
The great stones. Roger came and said there was something amiss there, something the Queen must look into. He was her son, but she did not take great account of his wisdom, or believe him when he spoke of trouble with the stones. She was a charter mage, and felt nothing wrong. Besides, she was winning at Cranach, so she told him to wait till morning. Roger turned to me, asked me to intercede, and, charter help me, I did. I believed Roger. I trusted him. With the stones, she was a charter mage, and felt nothing wrong. Besides, she was winning at Cranach, so she told him to wait till morning. Roger turned to me, asked me to intercede, and, charter help me, I did. I believed Roger. I trusted him, and my belief convinced the Queen. Finally, she agreed. By that time the sun had set. With Roger, myself, 3 guards, and 2 ladies-in-waiting, we went down into the reservoir where the great stones are. Touchstone's voice faded to a whisper as he continued and grew hoarse.
There was terrible wrong down there. But it was Roger's doing, not his discovery. There are 6 great stones, and 2 were just being broken. Broken with the blood of his own sisters, sacrificed by his free magic minions as we approached. I saw their last seconds, the faint hope in their clouding eyes as the Queen's barge came floating across the water. I felt the shock of the stones breaking, and I remember Rogier stepping up behind the Queen, a saw-edged dagger striking so swiftly across her throat. He had a cup, a golden cup, one of the Queen's own, to catch the blood, but I was too slow, too slow!
So the story you told me at Hole Hallow wasn't true, Zabriel whispered, as Touchstone's voice cracked and faded, and the tears rolled down his face. The Queen didn't survive.
No, mumbled Touchstone. But I didn't mean to lie. It was all jumbled up in my head.
What did happen?
The other 2 guards were Rogier's men, Touchstone continued, his voice wet with tears, muffled with sorrow. They attacked me. But Vlaire, one of the ladies-in-waiting, threw herself across them. I went mad, battle-mad, berserk. I killed both guards. Rogier had jumped from the barge and was wading to the stones, holding the cup. His 4 sorcerers were waiting, dark, cowled around the 3rd stone, the next to be broken. I couldn't reach him in time, I knew. I threw my sword. It flew straight and true, taking him just above the heart. He screamed, the echo going on, and he turned back towards me, transfixed by my sword, but still walking, holding that vile cup of blood up as if offering me a drink. You may tear this body, he said, as he walked, rip it like some poor maid costume, but I cannot die. He came within an arm's length of me, and I could only look into his face, look at the evil that lay so close behind those familiar features. Then there was blinding white light, the sound of bells, bells like yours, Sabriel, and voices, harsh voices. Rogier flinching back, the cup dropped, blood floating on the water like oil. I turned, saw guardsmen on the stairs, a burning, twisting column of white fire, a man with sword and bells. Then I fainted, or was knocked unconscious. When I came to, I was in Hole Hallow, seeing your face. I don't know how I got there. Who put me there? I still only remember in shreds and patches.
You should have told me, Sabriel said, trying to put as much compassion in her voice as she could. But perhaps it had to wait for the sea's freeing of that binding spell. Tell me, the man with the sword and bells, was it the Abhorsen?
I don't know, replied Touchstone. Probably.
Almost definitely, I would say, added Sabriel. She looked at Mogget, thinking of that column of twisting fire. You were there too, weren't you, Mogget? Unbound, in your other form.
Yes, I was there, said the cat, with the Abhorsen of that time, a very powerful charter mage, and a master of the bells, but a little too good-hearted to deal with treachery. I had terrible trouble getting him to Belisaire, and in the end we were not timely enough to save the Queen or her daughters.
What happened? Whispered Touchstone. What happened?
Rogier was already one of the dead when he came back to Belisaire,
Mogget said wearily, as if he were telling a cynical yarn to a crew of hard-bitten cronies.
But only an Abhorsen would have known it, and he wasn't there.
Rogier's real body was hidden somewhere,
is hidden somewhere, and he wore a free magic construct for his physical form. Somewhere along the path of his studies, he'd swapped real life for power, and like all the dead, he needed to take life all the time to stay out of death. But the charter made it very difficult for him to do that anywhere in the kingdom, so he decided to break the charter.
He could have confined himself to breaking a few of the lesser stones somewhere far away, but that would only give him a tiny area to prey on, and the Abhorsen would soon hunt him down. So he decided to break the great stones, and for that he needed royal blood, his own family's blood, or Abhorsen's, or the Clare's, of course, but that would be much harder to get. Because he was the Queen's son, clever and very powerful, he almost achieved his aims. 2 of the 6 great stones were broken. The Queen and her daughters were killed. Abhorsen intervened a little too late. True, he did manage to drive him deep into death, but since his true body has never been found, Rogier has continued to exist. Even from death, he has overseen the dissolution of the kingdom. A kingdom without a royal family, with one of the great charters crippled, corrupting and weakening all the others. He wasn't really beaten that night in the reservoir, just delayed. And for 200 years he's been trying to come back, trying to re-enter life. He's succeeded, hasn't he? Interrupted Sabriel. He's the thing called Kerigor, the one Abhorsens have been fighting for generations, trying to keep in death. He is the one who came back, the greater dead, who murdered the patrol near Cloven Crest, the master of the Mordicant.
I do not know, replied Mogget. Your father thought so.
It is him, Touchstone said distantly. Kerigor was Rogier's childhood nickname. I made it up on the day we had the mud fight. His full ceremonial name was Rogirek. He or his servants must have lured my father to Belisair just before he emerged from death, Sabriel thought aloud. I wonder why I'm out into life so near the wall.
His body must be near the wall. He would need to be close to it, Mogget said.
You should know that. To renew the master spell that prevents him from ever passing beyond the final gate.
Yes, replied Sabriel, remembering the passages from the Book of the Dead. She shivered, but suppressed it, before it became a racking sob. Inside, she felt like screaming, crying. She wanted to flee back to Anselstier, cross the wall, leave the dead and magic behind, go as far south as possible. But she quelled these feelings and said, "An Abhorsen defeated him once. I can do so again. But first, we must find my father's body." There was silence for a moment, save for the wind in the canvas and the quiet hum of the rigging. Touchstone wiped his hand across his eyes and looked at Mogget. "There is one thing I would like to ask. Who put my spirit in death and made my body the figurehead?"
"I never knew what happened to you," replied Mogget.
His green eyes met Touchstone's gaze, and it wasn't the cat who blinked.
"But it must have been Abhorsen. You were insane when we got you out of the reservoir. Driven mad, probably by the breaking of the great stones. No memory, nothing. It seems 200 years is not too long for a rest cure. He must have seen something in you. Or the Clare saw something in the ice. Oh, that was hard to say. We must be nearing the city, and the sea's influence lessens. The binding resumes.
No, Mogget, exclaimed Sabriel. I want to know, I need to know who you are. What's your connection with the great? Her voice locked up in her throat, and a startled gargle was the only thing that came out.
Too late, said Mogget.
He started cleaning his fur, pink tongue darting out, bright color, against white fur. Sabriel sighed and looked out at the turquoise sea, then up at the sun, yellow disk on a field of white-streaked blue. A light breeze filled the sail above her, ruffling her hair in passing. Gulls rode it on ahead to join a squawking mass of their brethren, feeding from a school of fish, sharp silver bursting near the surface. Everything was alive, colorful, full of the joy of living. Even the salt tang on her skin, the stink of fish, and her own unwashed body were somehow rich
and lively. Far, far removed from Touchstone's grim past, the threat of Rogier, Kerrigor, and the chilling greyness of death. "We shall have to be very careful," Sabriel said at last, "and hope that... What was it you said to the Elder of Nesto, Touchstone?" He knew immediately what she meant. "Hope that the Charter preserves us all." Chapter 19. Sabriel had expected Belisair to be a ruined city, devoid of life, but it was not so. By the time they saw its towers and the truly impressive walls that ringed the peninsula on which the city stood, they also saw fishing boats of a size with their own. People were fishing from them, normal, friendly people, who waved and shouted as they passed. Only their greeting was telling of how things might be in Belisair. "Good sun and swift water" was not the typical greeting in Touchstone's time. The city's main harbour was reached from the west. A wide, buoyed channel ran between two hulking defensive outworks, leading into a vast pool, easily as big as 20 or 30 playing fields. Wharves lined three sides of the pool, but most were deserted. To the north and south, warehouses rotted behind the empty wharves. Broken walls and hulled roofs, testimony to long abandonment. Only the eastern dock looked lively. There were none of the big trading vessels of bygone days, but many small coastal craft, loading and unloading. Derricks swung in and out, longshoremen humped packages along gangplanks, small children dived and swam in between the boats. No warehouses stood behind these wharves. Instead, there were hundreds of open-topped booths, little more than brightly decorated frameworks delineating a patch of space with tables for the wares and stools for the vendors and favoured customers. There seemed to be no shortage of customers in general, Sabriel noted, as Touchstone steered for a vacant berth. People were swarming everywhere, hurrying about as if their time was sadly limited. Touchstone let the main sheet go slack and brought the boat into the wind just in time for them to lose way and glide at an oblique angle into the fenders that lined the wharf. Sabriel threw up a line, but before she could leap ashore and secure it to a bollard, a street urchin did it for her.
"Penny for the knot!"
he cried, shrill voice piercing through the hubbub from the crowd.
"Penny for the knot, lady!"
Sabriel smiled, with effort, and flicked a silver penny at the boy. He caught it, grinned, and disappeared into the stream of people moving along the dock. Sabriel's smile faded. She could feel many, many dead here, or not precisely here, but further up in the city. Belisair was built upon four low hills, surrounding a central valley, which lay open to the sea at this harbour. As far as Sabriel's senses could tell, only the valley was free of the dead. Why? She didn't know. The hills, which made up at least two-thirds of the city's area, were infested with them. This part of the city, on the other hand, could truly be said to be infested with life. Sabriel had forgotten how noisy a city could be. Even in Anselstier, she had rarely visited anything larger than Bain, a town of no more than 10,000 people. Of course, Belisair wasn't a big city by Anselstieran standards, and it didn't have the noisy omnibuses and private cars that had been significantly adding to Anselstieran noise for the last 10 years. But Belisair made up for it with the people. People hurrying, arguing, shouting, selling, buying, singing.
"Was it like this before?"
she shouted at Touchstone as they climbed up onto the wharf, making sure they had all their possessions with them.
"Not really," answered Touchstone. "The pool was normally full, with bigger ships, and there were warehouses here, not a market. It was quieter, too, and people were in less of a rush."
They stood on the edge of the dock, watching the stream of humanity and goods, hearing tumult and smelling all the new odours of the city, replacing the freshness of the sea breeze. Cooking food, wood smoke, incense, oil, the occasional disgusting whiff of what could only be sewage. It was also a lot cleaner, added Touchstone. Look, I think we'd best find an inn or hostelry, somewhere to stay for the night.
Yes, replied Sabriel.
She was reluctant to enter the human tide. There were no dead among them, as far as she could sense, but they must have some kind of accommodation or agreement with the dead, and that stank to her far more than sewage. Touchstone snagged a passing boy by the shoulder as Sabriel continued to eye the crowd, nose wrinkling. They spoke together for a moment. A silver penny changed hands. Then the boy slid into the rush, Touchstone following. He looked back, saw Sabriel staring absently, and grabbed her by the hand, dragging both her and the lazy fox-fur-positioned Mogget after him. It was the first time Sabriel had touched him since he'd been revived, and she was surprised by the shock it gave her. Certainly her mind had been wandering, and it was a sudden grab. His hand felt larger than it should, and interestingly calloused and textured. Quickly, she slipped her hand out of his, and concentrated on following both him and the boy, weaving across the main direction of the crowd. They went through the middle of the open-topped market, along one street of little booths, obviously the street of fish and fowl. The harbour end was alive with boxes and boxes of fresh-caught fish, clear-eyed and wriggling. Vendors yelled their prices, or their best buy, and buyers shouted offers or amazement at the price. Baskets, bags and boxes changed hands, empty ones to be filled with fish or lobster, squid or shellfish. Coins went from palm to palm, or occasionally whole purses disgorged their shining contents into the belt pouches of the stall holders. Towards the other end it grew a little quieter. The stalls here had cages upon cages of chickens, but their trade was slower, and many of the chickens looked old and stunted. Sabriel, seeing an expert knife man beheading row after row of chickens and dropping them to flop headless in a box, concentrated on shutting out their bewildered, feather-brained experience of death. Beyond the market, there was a wide swath of empty ground. It had obviously been intentionally cleared, first with fire, then with mattock, shovel and bar. Sabriel wondered why, till she saw the aqueduct that ran beyond and parallel to this strip of wasteland. The city folk who lived in the valley didn't have an agreement with the dead. Their part of the city was bounded by aqueducts, and the dead could no more walk under running water than over it. The cleared ground was a precaution, allowing the aqueducts to be guarded, and sure enough, Sabriel saw a patrol of archers marching atop it, their regularly moving shapes silhouetted, shadow puppets against the sky. The boy was leading them to a central arch, which rose up through two of the aqueduct's four tiers, and there were more archers there. Smaller arches continued on each side, supporting the aqueduct's main channel, but these were heavily overgrown with thorn bushes to prevent unauthorized entry by the living, while the swift water overhead held back the dead. Sabriel drew her boat cloak tight as they passed under the arch, but the guards paid them no more attention than was required to extort a silver penny from Touchstone. They seemed very third-rate, even fourth-rate soldiers, who were probably more constables and watchkeepers than anything else. None bore the charter mark, or had any trace of free magic. Beyond the aqueduct, streets wound chaotically from an unevenly paved square, complete with an eccentrically spouting fountain. The water jetted from the ears of a statue of an impressively crowned man. King Anstir III, said Touchstone, pointing at the fountain. He had a strange sense of humour, by all accounts. I'm glad it's still there. Where are we going? Asked Sabriel. She felt better now that she knew the citizenry weren't in league with the dead. This boy says he knows a good inn, replied Touchstone, indicating the ragged urchin who was grinning just out of reach of the always expected blow.
Sign of Three Lemons, said the boy, Best in the city, lord, lady.
He had just turned back from them to go on, when a loud, badly cast bell sounded from somewhere towards the harbour. It rang three times, the sound sending pigeons racketing into flight from the square. "What's that?" asked Sabriel. The boy looked at